Okay, let's begin with our motivation. And think of all the things we need to stay alive: food, clothing, shelter, medicine. Think of all the things we need to be happy as social creatures, especially friends. And how all these things that surround us, that add to our well-being, all come from the efforts of other living beings. Those who grew our food, who made our clothes, built the buildings, built the highways, put in the telephone lines, the plumbing, people who pick up the garbage. We just think of all the things we use and enjoy on a day-to-day basis that we usually take for granted, and then see that all these come through the efforts of other living beings. Then we really see how dependent we are on others to stay alive. And we also realize their kindness in providing to us all these things. So whether or not they had us in mind when they went to work in the morning, the bottom line is we benefit from what they do. That we can't live in this world just by ourselves. And so really feeling that how we are part of a larger group, how we are not some independent being who can take care of themselves without needing anybody else. And we really see the kindness of others and experience ourselves as the recipient of kindness. And when we really do that, then automatically a sense of gratitude arises and a wish to repay the kindness that we've received. And the best way to repay that kindness is to be able to lead other living beings on the path to full awakening, showing them what to abandon, what are the causes of misery and how to abandon those, what are the causes of happiness and how to create those. And so to be able to guide others most effectively, we have to first be able to guide ourselves. We have to first purify our own mind, perfect our good qualities. And so for that reason, we aspire to full Buddhahood. And in order to attain full Buddhahood, we need to listen or study, to learn the teachings, to reflect on them, to meditate on them. And so that's what we're doing this evening. So let's have that as our motivation for being together. So often we have this sense of, here's me, I stand alone, I do what I want, I can take care of myself, I can make everything happen. It's really a joke, isn't it? We really, without other living beings participating, there's really no way we could take care of ourselves, is there? Is there? Yeah? And yet the very living beings who do so much to benefit us and supply us with what we need to stay alive, those are the ones that we get so mad at. Yeah? What do we tell our kitties? Don't bite the hand that feeds you? Yeah? But we do that. You know, we get mad at the sentient beings who are kind to us. And, you know, so we see their kindness in general, but sometimes, you know, just even in specific ways, people are very directly are trying to help us, but we see their help as harm, or they aren't helping us in the way we want them to help us, or as fast as we want them to help us. Yeah, and so we get mad at them. But actually, their motivation is one of kindness. You know, and often we can't see the kindness that's in front of our nose. Yeah. So what was that verse we did at lunch today? The drunken fool who...
brings suffering onto himself.
Yeah, who brings suffering onto himself. Yeah. So that's kind of what we do, don't we? Okay, so that's why we listen to teachings, to try and, you know, identify our wrong ways of thinking and our misperceptions, because only when we can identify them can we counteract them and correct them. So the Dharma's got to be like a mirror that shows us all of our zits. Yeah? Doesn't it? We want to look in the face, oh, look at this creamy complexion, you know. I look so beautiful, no wrinkles, no pimples. You know, like in the commercials. You know? You could sit and look at yourself. But actually, you know, when the Dharma acts as a mirror, what do we see? Yeah. Our wrinkles, our zits, you know. How our face isn't symmetrical, how, you know, all sorts of things, don't we? Yeah. You know, tons of freckles. I have so many freckles and moles, the Tibetans come up to me and they go like this. They want to touch them. What are all these things? Yeah? So we see all of that, but it's only when we see that that then we can do something about it. So in the teachings that we're doing now, you know, one of the things that we're looking in the mirror and seeing is our wrong conceptions, particularly the wrong conception that there is a soul or a permanent self. Yeah. And here by permanent we mean something that doesn't change moment to moment. Yeah. Because we say that everything that functions, you know, that functions in the world, yeah? It all, things that arise due to causes, that cease due to causes, you know, they're all temporary. They arise and they cease. They arise and they cease. They don't exist for a second moment. But, you know, we don't like thinking of ourselves as somebody who arises and ceases, do we? It's a little bit unnerving. I want to be something that's always here, unchangeable. Yeah. Everything else around can change, but there's a core inside me that is the true thing, that it really is me. You know, that God created or that naturally exists, whatever, you know, we dream up, but something that is permanently, essentially, the essence of me-ness. Yeah? And so we believe in such a self, and particularly when we encounter religions or philosophies that teach that, you know, that there's a permanent soul or a permanent self, then it's so comforting. Oh, yeah, everything else can change, but the I... You know, I am always here, unchanging. Okay? And so then, you know, we have all this philosophy to, you know, back that up. And yet the moment we start really questioning that, you know, asking ourselves, you know, is there really a permanent self, a permanent soul? Then we run into all sorts of contradictions. You know, and it just plain doesn't make any sense. And so when we see that and we, you know, really look at all these different ideas about how there could be a permanent self, and we see that none of them hold water, then the only thing we can do is give up the notion of a permanent self, of a true soul. It's the only possible thing we can do. We've looked, tried to examine every way it could possibly exist, and none of them work. Yeah, then we've got to give it up. So that's what this chapter in Aryadeva's 400 is talking about, you know. We're right in the middle of the chapter, and we've been examining, you know, this idea of a permanent self as it is explained by different non-Buddhist schools at the time of the Buddha, or actually in subsequent centuries too, you know, in like the first millennia and a half of Buddhism, you know, all these different views that different groups have about what the person really is, and refuting them. And, you know, some of these philosophies, their assertions, it's a little bit difficult to understand. Some of them are easier, and we can see that they actually have some relationship maybe to some things that we were taught as kids. Yeah? As a child, were you taught that there was a soul that God made? That's who you are? Yeah? So, you know, we were taught that kind of thing. People around us believed it, so we believed it. Yeah? And dreamt up, you know, had some kind of philosophy proving it. But then, you know, as we get older and we start to think, could that exist? It becomes very difficult to assert an unchanging soul or an unchanging creator that made that soul. Because something that is unchanging, something that's permanent, does not change from moment to moment, which means that it can't cause anything else. Because being a cause means you change. You know, if something causes something else, that cause has got to change in order for the effect to arise, doesn't it? You know, when you plant the seed in the ground, the seed's got to change for the sprout to arise. It's not that the seed stays there forever and a sprout appears magically. Yeah. The seed has to change for the sprout to arise. Now, in the same way, you know, the child has to completely transform for the adult to arise. Yeah, you can't be both a child and an adult at the same time, although we try and be sometimes. Yeah, in the same way, you can't be a seed and a sprout at the same time. Yeah. So something that is permanent cannot produce an effect because it's frozen, it's static. Yeah? So it can't produce something else, and it also can't be a product of something else. It doesn't have any causes. Because if something is permanent, again, it couldn't have arisen from a cause. Yeah? Because the whole idea of causality is that the cause changes for the result to come into existence. Okay? So the result depends on the cause. And so, the more we think about this, then if we try and see, okay, there's a permanent thing that is me, that is unchanging, some permanent soul that is me, yeah? And then you say, well, what is it? If it's permanent, yeah, then it doesn't depend on any causes and conditions. It can't produce any effects. So what in the world is this soul that I supposedly have? Yeah, what is it? And can something permanent go on to the next life? Yeah, because something going to the next life means it has to change. Yeah, if your soul is who you really are, and yet it doesn't change, then how can you go to the next life? Or how could you go to heaven, or how could you go to hell? If your soul is permanent, it doesn't change. There's no way to go to heaven, there's no way to go to hell. Because that soul is, you know, is always what it is. Okay? And then if you think, oh, well, there was a, you know, a permanent cause that created me. Some, you know, God is permanent. Yeah, God doesn't change. Some creator being that's permanent. But again, how can something that's permanent create something else? Yeah, things that are permanent can't create. And then if you say, well, God was impermanent, meaning God changes, then you have to ask, well, then what was the cause of God? Yeah, what was the cause of God? That becomes a little difficult. I used to ask these questions when I was a little kid. I didn't know anything about Buddhism. But I, you know, would think about this. Like, who created God? It's like, you're not supposed to ask that question. Don't ask. It's a mystery. Yeah. It's a mystery. It really was a mystery. Yeah? Okay? So this is the kind of thing that we're looking at here and really questioning, can it exist? So right now, we've been talking about the Samkhya school. Yeah, Jeffrey mentioned this last Tuesday. So the Samkhya school talks about 25 elements or things that exist. One of them, the person, is impermanent, and all the other 24 are permanent. Okay, and that there's this principle, or, you know, universal substance, yeah, out of which everything is created. That's kind of like a New Age idea, too. Or it could be, you know, I mean, in different religions, too, that there's some universal substance, the oneness of everything, and out of that, everything is created. I mean, it sounds really nice, doesn't it? Yeah? This permanent substance that never changes, that's always there, but out of which we all appear, and out of which we all absorb the end. But if it's permanent, how can we come out of it? And if our soul is permanent, how can a permanent soul be produced? Okay? So remember, the Samkhyas say that there's a permanent person. And and we were at verse 236, so it was kind of following from last week. It says, a substantial entity, unlike an action, does not alter until it disintegrates. Thus it is improper to claim the person exists, but consciousness does not. Okay? So the Samkhyas are saying that there's the person and there's the activity of being conscious. And they're one entity. Okay? So if that were the case, then you would have to experience the object or be conscious of the object until the person disintegrates. Yeah, because they're one entity, so they arise and cease at the same time. But the person is permanent, so the person isn't going to cease. So that means whatever you experience, you just have to keep experiencing. Okay? So the experience would continue until the person disintegrated, but the person's permanent, so it doesn't disintegrate. Okay? Or the person should change when the experience ends, in which case the person couldn't be permanent. Okay? This has to do with the Samkhya view, which we're not going to go into a lot of details about that. Okay? Okay. Then, verse 237. At times one sees potential consciousness, at others consciousness itself. Because of being like molten iron, the person undergoes change. Okay? So the Samkhyas are having a hard time saying that there's always consciousness, you know, because then it would have to last as, you know, consciousness of a perfect, of a certain object would have to last as long as the person does. So now they're saying, okay, that there's sometimes there's the potential of consciousness and sometimes there's consciousness. Okay? So they say that there's no consciousness before you experience the object. Okay, although there's no consciousness before you experience the object, it's potential and thus the person exists. Okay, so before I perceive the green, there's no visual consciousness perceiving green, but there's the potential to experience green. And that potential is the same substantial entity with the self, with this permanent self. Okay? Because they can't say that the consciousness is there before the object. You know, the visual consciousness apprehending green doesn't exist before you apprehend green. Okay? So then they're saying the potential does. And so then the potential is the person. And then the potential changes into the actual consciousness, and then the consciousness is the person. Okay? So then the response to that is, when objects aren't being, then according to you, when objects aren't being experienced, there is the potential of consciousness, and when they are, consciousness itself exists. In that case, like molten iron that later becomes a solid mass, the potential for consciousness becomes consciousness itself. Therefore, because you say the person and consciousness are one entity, then the person must change. Okay? So the whole idea is, you know, whatever they're asserting, how can you say that first there's the person who's one with the potential for consciousness, and then there's the person who is conscious, and it changed from the potential of consciousness to consciousness, but somehow the self didn't change. But the self is both of those things. It doesn't make any sense. Okay? Okay, so then verse 238. Okay, so this is the Nyayayikas, their assertion, okay? So they, I'll read the verse first. Merely a small part with mind is consciousness, but the person is as vast as space. Therefore, it would seem as though its nature is not to be conscious. So the Nyayayikas say that there's a permanent person that is extensive like space, but is not a conscious entity. So there's this permanent person, permanent soul, that's as extensive as all space, exists everywhere. The idea of I am one with everything. Yeah, that's what that is. I am one with everything. Yeah. This person is not consciousness, but there's one part of the person that is the mere size of a particle that has mind. So I am this amorphous one thing that is oneness with everything. It sounds good, doesn't it? Yeah? It's amorphous, wonderful. It's oneness with everything. You know, this permanent. And one part of it, one little particle of it, is conscious. Yeah? Okay? So that's why there's consciousness of objects. So a person that is conscious and not separate from mind is produced from this association of this particle of the self that associates with consciousness. So then the response to that is, since except for a part as small as a particle, the rest of this permanent and extensive self isn't conscious of objects. Okay. Yeah, so the rest of the self is not conscious of objects, except for this little bit. Okay. So just as we don't say that the water of the Ganges River is salty because of its contact with a grain of salt, you wouldn't say that this person cognizes things because a tiny part of it does. Okay? Most of the person isn't conscious. So how can you, the person, you know, how can the person and the consciousness be the same? Okay? Yeah? So that leaves most of this extensive permanent entity as not related to consciousness. Because there's only this little atom that is. So what in the world is this permanent self that is as extensive as space? What in the world is it?
Space. That's all it can be.
But space is unobstructed.
Right.
Nothingness.
Right.
Yeah? So then that presents some problems, you know, doesn't it? Okay, so then the next view is for people who believe in a permanent omnipresent self. Okay, so here the verse says, if the self is in everyone, then why does another not think of this one as I? It is unacceptable to say that it is obscured by itself. Okay, so now, you know, forget this, you know, amorphous kind of substance that is the person that's oneness with everything. Forget that. Now there's a permanent omnipresent self. Okay, yeah. And so before, you know, this was this amorphous substance and only this particle was conscious. Now there's this conscious self that is omnipresent like space and oneness with everything. Again, the idea, I am oneness with everything, right? I mean, how many times did you drop acid and think that? Yeah? I mean, you read all the books from, you know, from Timothy Leary and, you know, whatever. I'm oneness with everything. Yeah, there's this big I. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is one with everything. As soon as you say I and everything, there's duality. You can't possibly be one. Can you be? You know, everybody says, oh, I felt like I was one with everything. Well, as long as you're feeling I, you're not one with everything. Okay? So here there's these people who believe in a permanent omnipresent self. Okay? So it's partless. If there's a permanent partless self, so it's partless because it's this unified I that's one with everything. But it's omnipresent like space and it exists in each sentient being. Okay, so the self that is that doesn't have parts, that doesn't change, yeah, but is in every sentient being, if such a thing existed, then why do I say I in relationship to these aggregates, and you say I in relationship to those aggregates, and you say I in relationship to your body and mind, and you say I in relationship to your body and mind? Because if there's one universal self that's present in everything, we should all say I together and feel I together. Yeah? So I should feel like I am all of you. Right? Yeah? And I should be all of you. So then, like I keep saying, then your bank account becomes my bank account. Because we're all one. Right? We're all one. So whatever belongs to you belongs to me.
Isn't another Beatles song there too? I am you and you are me and we are all together.
Oh! Yeah! Okay.
Come together.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, another root test for another teaching at Cartesian. The joke is, there's this one place in Sandpoint. It's a kind of a metaphysical church, and they invite me sometimes to speak. And so one time, you know, in their service, they sang the song The Rose by Janis Joplin. You know, this is the church, part of the church service. So then I made that the topic of my sermon, my Dharma talk, and I gave a commentary on the meaning of the rose. And then I went there a couple of weeks ago, and they were, and they sang John Lennon's Imagine. And so I made that the topic of the talk that I gave. Yeah, so it looks like, you know?
I don't think they're going to sing this one at Gardena.
No, I am you and you are me and we are all together. It sounds like something they would sing. Yeah? Oh, come on. You're so conservative.
I am. It's the lack of a synthesizer. I don't think you can do it.
Okay, so the question is, you know, if we're all part of this one big self, why don't we feel I in relationship to each person's body and mind?
Because we're afflicted.
Yeah, and that's exactly what they say. They say because the other person's self obscures it. Yeah. Right. So I don't look at your aggregates and think I because yourself is obscuring me from doing that. But that contradicts their own tenets, yes, that we're all one. Okay? So, you know, if there's no duality between these two selves, then we can't say yourself obscures myself from seeing your body and mind as me. Okay? So, then verse 240. There is no difference between the insane and those for whom the attributes are the creator, but are never conscious. My computer was running out of ink here. So that's why I'm going like this. Okay, so here we're going back to the Samkhya view, that there's this principle of prakriti that is matter, that is the creator of everything. And what Aryadeva is saying is, you know, there's no difference between the insane and those for whom the attributes of, what were the attributes? Pleasure, pain, and equanimity. Remember, they were the attributes, you know, saying that those are conscious. You know, there's basically what Aryadeva is saying is if you believe in these things, you're nuts, yeah. Okay? So how can something that is not conscious, such as the principle, become conscious? Yeah, something that's not conscious can't become conscious. Or how can something that is not conscious, even like the principle, create consciousness? And this would be a very good question for the scientists. You know, when you talk to scientists and they say, well, I talked to one of them, and he said the mind is an emergent property of the brain. Now, what does emergent property mean?
It comes after the active brain.
Okay, so there's the brain, and the mind comes out of the brain, after the brain. But the brain is physical matter. The mind is conscious experience. How can physical matter produce conscious experience? Yeah, how does that happen? Yeah, that this is the puzzle, and this is where science gets stuck. You know, when you say that, you know, there's the little bitty life forms in the ocean, and then somehow between there and, you know, then there's some kind of conscious life, somehow something happens. But what exactly that is, how would consciousness, the ability to experience, to cognize, to feel pain, pleasure, to know objects, to relate to objects, how can that come out of something that is just inanimate matter? Yeah, because they have two different natures. Two very, very different natures. Yeah. That's not to say the body and mind don't influence each other. Clearly they influence each other. Yeah. But saying that one is the substantial cause of the other, that one becomes a little bit difficult. Yeah. And like the story I always tell of the Mind and Life Conference, with His Holiness and some scientists. There was one scientist there, this was 1989, who was really reductionist. You know, the brain is the mind is the person. And I remember that afternoon, you know, some of us talking at the end and saying, you know, can you imagine what he, you know, if, you know, if his wife's brain is on the table, you know, he would say, I love you, dear. You know? Or if his wife says to him, I love you, he says, wait, I need your galvanic skin response, and I need to see what's going on with your synapses in your brain. And that's how I'll tell if you really love me. This can be a great marriage, huh? Okay, then, did I finish that? Yeah. Okay, so then verse 241, what is more illogical than that the attributes should always know how to construct homes and so forth, but not know how to experience them? Okay? So remember, there's this principle with the attributes of pain, pleasure, and equanimity. Yeah. And these attributes can create, you know, because everything comes out of the principle. So these things can create a house. Yeah. They know how to construct a home and so forth. But none of them are consciousness. So they can't experience it. Okay. So, Aryadeva says, your assertions contradict worldly conventions and experience. How can the attributes of pleasure, pain, and equanimity know how to build houses, etc., but not know how to experience these things? Because only the person experiences, because only it is conscious. Remember? Mm-hmm. Yeah, only the person can experience things. So this contradicts reason, it contradicts convention. Then verse 242, okay, the active is not permanent. The ubiquitous is actionless. The actionless is like the non-existent. So why don't you prefer selflessness? Okay, so this is refuting that a permanent self is the agent of actions and the experience of the maturation of those actions. So the Vaisheshikas, they say that the self alone is the doer of actions and the experiencer of their results. Okay? So there's a permanent self that is the agent that acts and that goes on to another life and experiences the results of the actions it created in a previous life. So a permanent self that acts, that creates karma, goes on to the next life and experiences the result without changing because it's permanent. So you have a problem here, don't you? Okay. Because it can't be permanent. If it's an agent that acts, okay, action means that there's change. Yeah? If I act, I am changing. That's the whole idea about God creating. You know, God can't remain the same and create. God's got to change. If I act and do something, I change in the process of what I'm doing. I'm not exactly the same I was as I was before I did that thing. Okay? So if you say there's a permanent self, then I can't possibly do any actions, create any karma, do anything at all. Okay? And even if I were able to, since I'm permanent, I couldn't experience the result because something that's permanent can't be influenced by causes. Because something that's permanent can't change, so other causes and conditions can do all they want, but it can't change, so then there can be no experience of the result. Okay? So permanent self can't act and create the karma, and it can't experience the result either, because both of those processes entail change. Okay? So that which performs functions like coming and going can't be permanent, since it changes. Yeah? When you go from here to here, you change. When you go from one life to the next life, you change. So the whole, something, the whole of which is everywhere, all the time, we're back to this ubiquitous, expansive self, doesn't perform activities like coming and going, since there is no place or time it doesn't occupy. So if there's some permanent self that's everywhere, how can it come and go? Because it's everywhere. Okay? So then they kind of say, okay. Then there's an actionless self that exists. Yeah? There's a self that is actionless. But then this actionless self would be permanent, and it couldn't create any action, so it can't, you know, action means karma, so it can't act, so then it can't experience any of the results of actions. Okay, an actionless self is non-existent, like a sky flower, or a rabbit's horn, or a turtle's mustache. Yeah. So then he says, so why don't you prefer selflessness? You know, so like, you know, hey, we've been talking about this permanent self that you think exists for a really long time. It can't be an actor. It can't experience the result. Why don't you just give up all that and recognize that such a thing doesn't exist? Selflessness means the absence of that kind of self. Yeah, it's worth doing, because if you give up all those ideas of that kind of permanent self, then you'll attain liberation. Okay? But we're stubborn, so we keep believing things, even though they don't make sense. So verse 243. Some see it as ubiquitous, and for some the person is the mere size of the body. Some see it as a mere particle. The wise see it as non-existent. Okay? So this is a general refutation of all these ideas that we've had before. So the whole conception or idea of a personal self, you know, a permanent personal me-ness, you know, is erroneous. Because if such a self existed, it would exist under its own power, by way of its own entity, you know, as some self-enclosed thing that was objective, that couldn't be influenced by anything. Okay? So something that was like that, that was objective, self-enclosed, then if it was, you know, really objective and self-enclosed, then everybody should see it in exactly the same way. So if there were this permanent self, objectively, everybody should see it, and everybody should see it in the same way. However, oh, and everybody should also say I in dependence on the same aggregates. Okay? However, you know, the problem is that the Vaisheshikas and the Samkhyas see the self as existing in each body and also as being ubiquitous, like space existing everywhere. The Jains see the self, yeah, as proportionate to the size of the body. So yourself is as big as an ant if you're an ant, or yourself is as big as an elephant if you're an elephant. Okay, so the cells are different sizes. This other school that we were talking about earlier, okay, they see the self as a mere particle. Okay? So if there were such a self, why are there so many different assertions about it? If it really did exist objectively, everybody should see it exactly the same way. Okay? So the conclusion is, yeah, those who correctly perceive the emptiness or selflessness of functional phenomena see that such a permanent personal self is non-existent. Okay? If the self existed by its own entity objectively as a self-enclosed phenomena, then everybody would see it the same way. And that's not what happens. Okay? And all of their different ideas have been refuted. Okay, now this verse I really like, verse 244. How can that which is permanent be harmed, or the unharmed be liberated? Liberation is irrelevant for one whose self is permanent. Mm-hmm. Okay? So, if you assert a permanent self, then attaining liberation is irrelevant, because a permanent self cannot change, and attaining liberation means you have to change. So if there's a permanent self, forget liberation. It's impossible to attain. Yeah. And if there were a permanent self, then a permanent self cannot be harmed in samsara. It also wouldn't experience any suffering, because again, something that's permanent can't change. And if you experience suffering, you change, don't you? Okay? So a permanent self can't be harmed in samsara, and it also can't be liberated and attain nirvana. It can't do anything. Yeah, a permanent self can't do anything. It's the turtle's mustache in the sky. Yeah, or the flower growing out of the turtle's head, or, you know, whatever we want to invent. We can invent some. We don't have to use the rabbit's horn and what they keep saying. We can invent our own. Okay. And then verse 245, if the self exists, it is inappropriate to think there is no self, and false to claim one attains nirvana, though certain through certain knowledge of reality. Okay? So this is talking about the inappropriateness of asserting the existence of a self during liberation. Okay? So if the self exists, like in samsara, it's inappropriate to think that there's no self. Or if there's a self that exists in liberation, then it's inappropriate to think there's no self in samsara. Okay? And it's false to also claim that one attains nirvana through a certain knowledge of reality. Because, yeah? Okay, so if the self existed from its own side, then you can't think there is no self. Because you're saying there's a self that exists objectively from its own side. Okay? In that case, the attainment of liberation is not feasible because the basis for self-grasping is still intact. You know, there's still this idea of a permanent, substantial, inherently existent self. Yeah. So with that kind of mind, self-grasping mind, that thinks that such an inherently existent self exists, yeah, then you can't attain liberation because you're holding on to the cause of samsara. Okay? To assert that there is a self and that through ascertaining knowledge of suchness or emptiness, one abandons self-grasping and attains nirvana is nonsensical, because realization of emptiness is realization of no self that is existing from its own side. Okay? So you're asserting that there's a self, and through ascertaining certain knowledge of emptiness, one abandons self-grasping, okay, and attains nirvana. That is ridiculous, because how can you abandon self-grasping if the object of your self-grasping is something that exists from its own side, that is truly existent out there objectively? Yeah, because your basis for your grasping is still very much intact. You're still holding on to that nature of a false self. Therefore, those who seek liberation should accept selflessness. Okay? So the path to liberation is the realization of selflessness. Yeah? But if you don't negate the self, then there's no way of getting rid of the ignorance that grasps it. Okay? So if you say that the self exists by way of its own nature, but you attain certain knowledge about the emptiness of the self, and that's what liberates you, then that's contradictory, because the emptiness of the self would mean that that very self that you're asserting exists doesn't exist. Okay? 246. If it exists at liberation, it should not be non-existent before. It is explained that what is seen without anything. It is explained that what is seen without anything is its nature. Okay, so this is refuting a substantially established liberated person without a self. Okay? Yeah, so there's this inherently existent, substantially existent person. Yeah. But you, that has realized selflessness, that has related, that has refuted some kind of personal self. So it's totally contradictory, isn't it? Yeah. So fearing the absurd consequences that self-grasping would exist in the liberated state if the self existed, okay, Because if the self existed, then self-grasping would have to be there in the liberated state. So then someone doesn't like that. So then they say that although there's no self, there's a truly existent liberated person. Okay, so you've realized selflessness, that there's no self that exists from its own side, but there's a truly existent self that exists from its own side that attained liberation. Right. Okay? So then there must be a truly existent liberated person during samsara too. If there's a truly existent liberated person in enlightenment, then there must be a truly existent objective individual that exists in samsara too. Because that self has an entity that is independent of all other factors. And its nature is perceived by an unmistaken awareness. Okay, so if there is a self at the time of liberation, then there should be a self before that too. But if there is no self during liberation, there should not be a self during samsara either. So you can't say there's a self at liberation and no self in samsara. And you can't say there's no liberated self, but there is a self at samsara. Yeah. So make up your mind already. Yeah. So that's why we say, because their whole notion of what the self is incorrect. As soon as you assert a self that has its own nature, yeah, that is something from its own side, independent of other factors, then you're really stuck. Yeah? You're really stuck because that kind of person can't change. That kind of person can't be affected by anything else because it is self-enclosed, objective. Yeah? So such a person couldn't exist in samsara and then get destroyed at the time of liberation. And such a person couldn't exist at the time of liberation but not exist before, because it'd have to be created, you know. So then what we're saying, you know, is there is a self, but it's the self that exists in name only. In other words, you say there is a person, but when you try and point to exactly what that person is, you can't isolate something that is it. So on the conventional level, we say, I walk, I talk, I create actions, I experience the result. And that all works on a conventional level. We all know what we're talking about. But if you try and find the person, you investigate inside the body and mind or separate from the body and mind and try and find out exactly who you are, what are you going to point to? Yeah, what is the self that you're going to point to that walks and talks and thinks and is happy and is sad and bakes cookies and what are you going to point to either in your body and mind or separate from your body and mind and say that is, can you point to anything? We can't. We can't. But we also can't say that there's no person because we say, you know, I sit and I stand and I think and I, you know, I'm listening to teachings and I'm thinking about the teachings. So we exist. But when we search for who we are, we can't find anything. And those two things are not contradictory. Okay? Because there is a self that is dependent on causes and conditions and parts and on being conceived and designated. There is that dependent self. But when you search for what it is, you can't find it. Yeah? It's there, it appears when you don't search, and it's dependent arising. But when you search, it vanishes. Yeah? It's kind of like, you know those, they have these drawings with like lots of dots and of different colors and things. And when you look at it in a certain way, you can see like a person or an animal in it. But then when you look at it in another way, that thing that you saw in it is gone.
Like the pointillist, where the closer you got to the picture, the more the image disappears, and the farther back you stand, and you see what's
Yeah, there. Exactly. Yeah. Kind of like an optical illusion. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Something appears, and you try and find out what it is, it disappears. Yeah. So you can't say it's non-existent, totally non-existent. Because there is a person that functions and does things. But you also can't say that the person is some truly existent objective thing there that is the essence of me-ness. Can't say that either. So with that, okay. Okay.
So the first one is, it feels that there should be something that is the same over time in order to determine, observe change from a prior moment to a later moment. You know, something that was just present there at both the prior moment and the later moment.
Okay. So it feels like there should be something that is permanent so that you can say that there is something that changes. Right?
Observe the change.
Okay, so there should be something permanent so that you could observe this permanent thing change moment to moment.
Well, the passage of time, that would be something to gauge things changing, but it isn't influenced by it, right?
Yeah, that's what it's saying. That it's something that isn't influenced by change, and yet through it you could gauge change happening. How's that going to work? Yeah. So this is how our grasping at inherent existence works. You know, we feel there's really got to be something there. Because unless you find something you can identify, then how can you say it changes? Yeah. Unless you can identify something that is the child, how can you say the child grows up? But if you can identify something that is the child, independent of everything else, then how can that child grow up? It couldn't grow up. Okay? So this is exactly how our grasping works.
And the second one is there anything that changes so slowly that it approaches being permanent?
Is there anything that changes so slowly that it approaches being permanent and unchanging?
But it's not.
But it's not permanent.
For example, what maybe the mind of someone in the personal bliss of nirvana, could that be mistaken for permanent?
Okay, so the mind of somebody in the personal peace of nirvana, could that be mistaken as permanent? No. Because the idea of something, things have got to arise and cease in each moment, because if they don't, then it's like saying something arises, so it changes. Then it's the same without changing over a period of time. And then it changes. And it ends. You know, that's what changing so slowly means. It arises, then it's permanent, and then it ceases. Okay. If it arises, that moment of arising, it's impermanent. How does something impermanent become permanent? How does something that arose due to a cause that's intricately involved in the whole causal system not produce an effect itself? And if it was permanent for a while, then what would make it become impermanent again? Okay. And then you say, well, it's not like that, not like, well, it changes and then it's the same that goes out. It just changes so slowly. But how can it change so slowly if it's not the same at some point as in the previous moment? Yeah? So even though there might be something that looks the same to our senses, that, you know, momentarily it looks the same, it doesn't mean that it is the same. It just means that we do not have the kind of meditative concentration and mindfulness that can see it changing moment to moment. But just because we can't see it change doesn't mean it isn't.
It's actually appearing to us, but we're not ascertaining it.
Yeah. The change is there, but we are too gross to see it.
So actually we have to search for the I, if it's existing or not, so to realize that. And how is it relating to the debate
between Hashan and Kamala Shila? That they weren't debating the nature of the I, they were debating what concentration meant.
Oh, concentration.
Yeah, their debate was about concentration.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Losang's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Guru Namanda Kamnyatayami. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially at Shravasti Abbey in the west floor.